Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback Writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, show number 130, and this is, again, the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. I am your host, Tom Riedel, and co-host Terry Brown will be with us shortly. Brief intro to today's show. Tonight we have on Rita Bozzi, and she's bringing on her experience as a writer and also her book, When I Was Better, and she would be along to talk to us about 15 minutes after the hour. And now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line, and we will get back to you. A special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to Apple Podcasts and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Readsy Discovery. They both do a great deal to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both sites as well. Upcoming authors on the Writer's Lounge on January 23rd, 2 weeks from tonight, An Enemy Like Me by our very own Terry M. Brown. Terry Brown will discuss her just-released new novel, On an Enemy Like Me, a World War II story about the moral and patriotic struggles of going to war while hanging on to the love of family. And on February 6, 2023, author Dustin Grinnell will be with us, and the title of the book is yet to be announced, but we'll update that information within the next week. I hope you'll tune in to these exciting upcoming shows. And right now, I would like to bring in the co-host, which is, of course, I just mentioned her. That would be Terry Brown. And She makes her way over here to have the seat next to me. And
hello,
she's a very
hello.
Busy.
How are you today?
Very busy lady these days. You are.
Well, that's all right. I like being busy. It keeps
and
me
I
out
like,
of trouble.
Like saying that I'm kind of pulling you in with a rope to pull you down to the seat because you've been floating way up there with the release of your second book about to be put out there. And how's that been going for you? It's pretty exciting, I bet.
Yeah, things are going really well. I've started a little launch tour, and I've had quite a few reviews going up. And, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's very different this time around than last time around. So I know a little bit more about marketing and know what I should be doing.
Yeah, it's the old experience that's finally kicking in, I think.
Yeah.
But it's still it probably still brings up a little bit of anxiety. Am I right, Terry?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, a little bit of anxiety and just, you know, you never really know. You think you're doing the right things. You don't really know. So, yeah, I'm pretending that I know more this time than I did last time.
Well, how was your Christmas? Was it good?
Yeah, my Christmas was really nice. It was a little quieter than usual because, you know, we're still dealing with my husband's illness. But in general, you know, he's doing well. We got to see family. It was a good Christmas. How about you?
Great. Well, I took a trip out to the Midwest to my other home, as I call it, in the Twin Cities area. And I had to deal with a blizzard, which came down just as I landed, and it stayed until I left. So I had to deal
so
with...
So we know who brought it.
That they're saying I did, but, you know,
yeah.
I don't really come from that bad of an area as far as weather-wise right now. We're doing pretty good, but I had to deal with black ice. I had witnessed a 7-car pileup in the right-hand lane of me going down the highway. So I sort of white-knuckled my way through that pileup and made it to the other side, which I was very grateful for. And I was I was going to tour around a little bit, but that sort of inspired me to make my way to my brother's house. So It was a bit scary. So anyways, what I'd like to talk tonight to you about is when we read. I read a lot. I'm sure you probably read when you have time. I know you're busy. But when I read, I read for pleasure. But on another level, I hope my brain is sort of analyzing the structure of the novel. And they have a thing called muscle memory. So if you do it over and over a lot, if it's an exercise of some sort, your brain sort of takes over and develops that muscle so you don't even really have to think about it. And I'm hoping that when I'm reading these books, that that's what's happening. So when I sit down to actually write, which I don't do a lot of these days. I do a lot more reading, but when I do sit down to write, I'm hoping that it'll somehow get onto the page and that I'll learn from what I'm writing. And what I found out, Terry, is if I sit down and read a number one bestseller, I sometimes want to read it to find out why it made it to that point, you know, and just sort of absorb the story. Right now I'm reading a book called what is it called? I had it written down here. The House in the Pines. It's listed at number one, and it's authored by a woman by the name of Anna Reyes. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's R-E-Y-E-S if you want to look it up to the listeners that are out there. And I found out that it's her first novel, and it's already number one. So I'm into a really good book, according to what they say. And, of course, we haven't invited her on the show or anything, but I just wanted to read it to get a sense of what it's like or what kind of a story is out there that is shot up to number one. Because I do an awful lot of reading of first-time authors, and that's why we have the Writer's Lounge. And I was just wondering what you thought about that whole thing.
Yes, so I noticed that when I'm reading books, even ones that don't really catch me, like I'm in a book club, and so sometimes we'll have a book that is not really my genre or not something I would have picked up on my own, and maybe I'm having trouble getting into it. Even those books, I'm asking questions like, why? Why am I not getting into this book? What could be done here that would make me more interested? It's like your brain doesn't turn off because you know that not only are you a reader, but you are a writer. And so, you know, there are those questions. What is it that's drawing me in? What is making this a bestseller? Why am I so involved with this character? The only time I don't do that is if I pick a book that is completely out of my genre and is what I call a beach read. It's just a fast read that doesn't require a whole lot of thought. And other than that, I'm always analyzing them.
Right. And I also think that aside from, you know, plot construction, pacing, tone, point of view, the one thing that I think really pulls me into a story is, and I know you'll agree because you have talked about this in the past, but character development brings me in a lot. I know Stephen King does an awful lot of that in his stories. He engages the reader with his characters, and you become so involved with them that you have to go on to find out what they are going to do next. Not so much what's around them, but what kind of mischief or what kind of storyline are they going to advance into? And that I think is one of the ingredients of a good story, is you have to get the reader involved with the character and get them to either like them a lot or hate them a lot for the book to be good.
And I think that it's really important that at least one character is a character that your readers can somehow resonate with, like they can see themselves as that character, even if it's not someone like them at all. But the character's so well written that they feel like they kind of become that character while they're reading. I know that's really important for me. I like to get so lost in the book that I forget that I'm actually reading. I feel like I'm part of the story.
Right. Or even if the plot is something that we can relate to, such
exactly.
as what we've taken a big interest in is what do we write? Boy, I just dropped it out of my head here. We write historical fiction.
Historical fiction, yeah.
Right, so it's the history that kind of grabs us in the first instant, I think. Like with your book, Ukraine stands out because everybody is involved with Ukraine. So you kind of gravitate towards that, and then you pick up those characters afterwards. So that's why I like what we are writing a lot, because it already sets us up for, you know, what we're going to read, and then we get into the story. So it's just really interesting. And I think sometimes, you know, I don't really see that I'm sitting there being analytical about what I'm reading. I'm really reading for pleasure, but I know that I am kind of doing that in some ways. I am kind of examining how the story is being structured in the character development and everything else. But I found it really interesting because I really wonder how many writers out there actually read and really get into it. In other words, take notes or anything like that. I would like to know a little bit more about that.
That's curious. I'm wondering if anyone does. I don't do that. I think about it. Sometimes when the book is over, I'm thinking about, well, what did they do? Because I'm still thinking about this book. What is it? You know, why is that happening? But no, I don't take notes. I think I just, like you, hope I'm absorbing it.
Right. And then when we sit down, hopefully it transfers onto the page. So
exactly.
Anyway, let's get on to the main event tonight, and it would be the guest author interview. And that is with Rita Bazzi. I hope I'm pronouncing her name right, and hopefully she will tell me whether or not I am or not. But she wrote the book When I Was Better, and I want to remind everybody out there, if you're listening live, You can call in and talk to Rita, myself, and Terry at area code 914-219-0868. Once again, that's 914-219-0868. We'd love to hear from you. And now my review of When I Was Better. When I Was Better looks at the embattled relationship between Estevan and Tereza during the Nazi invasion and Soviet occupation of Hungary in 1956. Estevan is forced to leave his wife and infant son in Hungary during the time that the invaders have crushed the Hungarian Revolution. Estevan finally makes it to Canada, where he endeavors to start a new life and to hopefully wait for a future reunion with his wife and son. Tereza is left to endure the trauma of war in an occupied country and has to keep secrets amid the weight of humiliation, shame, isolation, and violent acts against her. Through the letters and faith, the couple struggles to maintain their relationship through the years, all the while holding out hope that they will someday be reunited. The novel highlights a refugee crisis, and it shows how an autocracy can corrupt its citizens into compliance. It also allows us to see how after over 60 years, we are still in danger of being ruled and having our families ripped apart. Rita Bosley is a brilliant storyteller and writer. She writes from experience and knowledge, being that she was raised by Hungarian refugees. Her characters are very well developed and engaging. Her descriptions of place and the details that were penned in most of the dramatic scenes placed me deep into her story. During this time, I think it's especially important to realize that we may live in a country where we believe we live in a stable democracy, but in reality, we are teetering on the edge of falling into the kind of lives that Estevan and Tereza love. It was a riveting and emotional story which kept me turning the pages. Rita Bosley has a talent, and I hope we will see more from this amazingly gifted writer and author. This is a must-read, and now it is our pleasure to welcome Rita Bosley to the Writer's Lounge, and I'll reach over here for the door handle and quickly pull the door open and hopefully bring her into the room to sit down with Terry and I. Rita, are you there?
I am here. Hello, Tom. Hello, Terry.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yes,
great.
We can.
I'm doing great. I'm so delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, and I understand you're calling from north of the border of where we sit.
That's right. I'm near the Canadian Rockies in Calgary, Alberta. And just because you were asking about my last name, it is in fact pronounced Bosey, a long O.
Bosey. Okay. We'll remember that. I hope I got your characters' names right, too.
Oh, that's okay. You know, it's Hungarian is a tricky language. here's a little hint for Hungarian words is always put the emphasis on the first syllable of the word.
Ah, okay.
Oh,
I'll remember that.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have been a very busy person over the years, and I had just friended you on Facebook and was really happy to see that you're engaged there as well, and I will be visiting you, and I'll also know that you're a dancer, an actor, and now you produced a story that puts you on the path to being a novelist. And so tell us about how all this got started.
I have a question for you, a specific question around that. Do you mean how did all the art get started or how did the novel get started? Because they're all sort of interwoven.
Well, let's do it this way. Let's take you back all the way back to your childhood. How did you get started in doing what you do and everything that you do?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's kind of a blessing and a curse because as a really astute therapist once said to me, she said, Rita, you've been working since the womb, and it's actually true. it's not a joke. You know, when you're a fetus inside the womb of a refugee, of an immigrant, you are working hard to keep that mother alive because,
yes,
you know, what people tend to forget is that people living in conditions of war, they're constantly in a state of fight, flight, and freeze. And that's really, really taxing on a woman's nervous system. And when they're living in an unstable environment and they come to a new environment and they can't speak the language and they haven't seen their possibly their partners for a number of years, they feel completely disoriented. So part of me has been probably working to love my mother and support my mother since the womb. And then I'm 57 now, and I've actually been working since the age of five because my father put me in the car, took me to the gas station, and I started working at the gas station at the age of five because this is, again, what you do as a refugee immigrant child is that you need to help bring money into the family. So I was either, you know, working in the womb, working at the gas station, and then somewhere around the age of about five or six, like all good immigrant children and refugee children, you want to make sure that you're excelling so that you impress everybody around you so that you fit in. So you become an overachiever, and I was taking piano lessons, ballet lessons, gymnastics lessons, skating lessons, every kind of lesson, because wow, you have to make sure that you're excelling, and not just excelling, but exceeding everybody else so that you are acceptable in this new society. So, yeah, that's a wow, Tom.
That's interesting, isn't it? One thing that I noticed about your story has a lot in common with my co-host, Terry. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her story, but she also wrote about something similar with the Ukraine crisis in the past and brought it to present. So congratulations on both of you for putting a story out there that's really got some legs to it and moving along pretty good from the reviews that I see. But Terry, what do you have to say to Rita?
So Rita, I'm curious, being raised by Hungarian refugees, do you feel like you patterned your characters off of your parents?
Of course I did. You know, of course I did. How can you not? I mean, they're part of you. We're part of each other. And as much as we want to think that we're different from our parents, it is very much the neurobiology of we. And our, you know, our minds are shaped by our parents and the cultures that we grow up in. No matter how much we think we aren't shaped by them, it goes unconscious. And then later on in life, you start to realize, oh, this is really strange. I'm starting to isolate myself. Why am I doing that? So definitely I did. And I also, not only that, I also brought parts of myself to the characters. So I'm in there, my parents are in there, other people that I know are in there, other relatives are in there, and just other things that the characters start to sort of have a life of their own and they start to tell me what's going on for them. So, you know, and I'm very much a writer that writes from my body. I listen in, I tune into sensations and feelings and images and things that are happening inside me, and I let what's happening in my own viscera speak the character and speak what's happening. So, yeah, it was a compilation, I would say.
Yeah.
That's what I say about my characters. Yeah, I agree.
So when you sit down to work with these characters, do you have any kind of outline at all? Do you keep track of each character and their characteristics? How does that work for you?
Oh my God. Well, this first novel was absolute mayhem, and it was an absolute reckless. You could say that I'm a pretty reckless writer, right? Because it was my first time writing a novel. I had no idea what it was going to take to write a novel. I really had no system. It was essentially disorganized attachments. If you know anything about attachment styles, it was like trauma writing this book. But luckily, I have an incredible husband who is also a dramaturge, and I had a phenomenal editor, a freelance editor from Toronto, Adrian Kerr, that I worked with for a number of years, so that as I was writing in this kind of reckless, haphazard way, they started to sort of steer me in a direction, and I didn't actually make any notes about where things were going. I was it was like a refugee. I didn't know where I was going to end up next, and then I started to realize through help from my husband, Ken Cameron, and Adrian Kerr, that I was going to have to, you know, start thinking about where did these characters start and where did they end up. And then when I worked with Atmosphere with Kyle McCord, he helped sort of steer me in a clearer direction with some questions he had about character development that were super helpful. So there were a lot of people that sort of helped steer me towards the destination. But, you know, if I were to write a novel again, oh my gosh, I learned so much. If I were to write a novel again, I would definitely have an outline. But, I mean, it was 750 pages when I started, and we whittled it down finally over years. And it was Dennis Bach, another incredible author in Toronto, that helped me. We finally whittled it down to what it be. It's about 500 pages. But, you know, I think you know, it's one of those things where, you know, whatever I was dealing with within myself was showing up inside the characters. That and I say, hey, which character can handle this right now, this part of me? whether it was a male or a female, it didn't really matter. So, no, Tom, there was no outline. It was pretty reckless.
Terry, did you have a similar experience in
yeah,
writing?
Well, I was going to say that, you know, she says that she hopes that, you know, with the next one that she would have an outline. I'm writing my third, and I still don't have an outline. I'm probably 75% done with the manuscript, and I don't know how it's going to end.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
I consider myself a panster. I mean, I let my characters talk to me. And then sometimes, you know, like once I've gotten this story out, I'll go back and make a lot of adjustments, you know, based on things that I understand about writing now. But that first draft, I just let it out. So I
Very
think
good.
It's okay to be
yeah.
reckless.
I think so.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because like I really didn't even know how to write. I mean, like, yes, I knew how to write, but I didn't really know how to write when I started the book, and I kind of learned how to write a novel. Essentially, I wrote other things, essays and short stories. But and then the other really important thing that I want to mention about characters, that's just a really great tip I learned from my husband, is essentially I had too many characters to begin with. It was like, what was it, Anna Karenina? Was it like 15 characters? I beat Tolstoy in that. I mean, I have like 25 characters. And my first mentor said, you've got way too many characters. But I needed them. And so what I did essentially later on was Ken, my husband, helped point out to me that you can combine characters and make a super rich character. So I would take two of them. It would be insane trying to rip apart the storyline to remove one and then give all that to the other character. But in the end, I was so happy I did that because it made all the other characters so much more complex.
I think all the readers out there would be surprised to hear, us talking, more so Terry and you, Rita, about the complexities of creating characters and getting them all onto the page, because it does sound like, it sounds like chaos, and somehow you both have honed it all in and brought them into a story where it's quite enjoyable and there's no chaos at all. So it's remarkable and almost miraculous what I think you've done to bring the stories together. But Rita, and doing this, writing this novel that you wrote, I like to talk about research. How does that impact your story, and what did you learn that may have surprised you about the research that you uncovered?
Oh yeah, well I love research. I could just spend afternoons doing that, going down rabbit holes, going on the internet, watching documentaries, reading other books. I mean, there was so much detail I learned about the events of the revolution, the chronology of it, what happened on a given day, political stuff. I had a lot of political stuff in my book early on. I mean, I know that some people aren't interested in, but I'm super interested in just in manipulation, the way people, how can you manipulate, I mean, I see it happening in so many different places. How can you manipulate votes? But you can do it. You know, it's so corrupt. It's horrendous. So I was really fascinated just to see how, you know, one political party could win all the votes and then another party take power through threatening people through manipulation. And so, you know, there was just a lot of detail that I learned about chronology, and that was really important to me to really bring the story to life so that it was grounded in reality. And then there was just, you know, what I found really touching as well and extraordinary was that entire classrooms of students fled together during the revolution. We had the University of Sopron transferred hundreds of students and professors to Canada. So these personal stories were just extraordinary, you know, how children, they fled on their own during the 1956 revolution, and then their parents would come for them in Austria and take them back. And, you know, just, you know, to the extent at which people were terrorized after they had left, you know, the long arm of communism, not just communism, any sort of authoritarian regime, just the way they could control your lives after they've left. I mean, you're seeing it happening also in Iran, people here in Canada that are worried for speaking out. So it was a lot, nothing specific, but other than, you know, the way people, when they really wanted freedom, they ran, they left, they went on foot, you know? So,
yeah. And I think, too, the year we have to remember is, you know, I was born in 1956, so all this was happening when I was born, but we back then didn't have the modern technology that we have today. It's a totally different world that we are living in, and that's sort of sometimes fun to look at. I know that Iran is going through a period of change right now where the people are rising up and they're using social media to get what they want, and it's not totally working, but it's on the right path. So imagine living back in those times when you really didn't have much, but, you know, the shoes on your feet and the shirt on your back to,
and whispering,
you know, to make it out of the country. Yeah,
that's right. And essentially word of mouth, right? Everything was word of mouth and telegrams and whatever you could do. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. And energy, the energy of the people just moving out there. Yeah,
exactly.
And I think, you know, some personal stories surprised me as well. There's some things I learned about my family as well. Do all families have secrets? And they're difficult, you know?
Right. Terry?
So I'm curious, did you ever feel like giving up when you were writing? and if so, what motivated you to keep writing anyway?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, so many times I had that sort of collapse state, you know, that I had that drive and then the collapse. I think sometimes when I got notes back, it could be a little bit not deflating in terms of the quality of the notes or the care that I got, but just the enormity of the job. And,
yeah,
you know, the amount of, I think I edited the book like 25 times from beginning to end. So it wasn't, essentially it wasn't, oh, actually I'm thinking about this. There were times where I thought the book was going to kill me because embodying these people and learning their stories was very depressing at times. It made me very sad. I sometimes would just break down and I'd be weeping on the floor of our basement where I had my writing studio at the time. So I thought maybe that would kill me, but that wasn't the thing. It wasn't the work of it that made me want to quit. It was actually the 50 rejections by agents and another 25 by publishers. So it was like 75 rejections in all in total. That was what was really painful because, you know, as a refugee, as an immigrant, you tend to look outside yourself to the society to see if the society will accept you or will they spit you out. And I get getting spit out. And I just thought, you know, is my story relevant to anyone? Does anybody care? And, you know, a book that's just sitting unopened or not even published is not really relevant. So there were times where I thought, you know, I'm going to erase it. I'm going to print it out and burn it. I'm going to print it out and put it, make a little coffin. I'm going to bury it. but, you know, that was really hard. That was 2 years of it. And then I just kind of gave up for a bit. I did actually give up for a bit. And different people gave me different bits of advice, and then I just had to kind of really let go. But what kept me going, you were asking what kept me going, is I really wanted to make something exquisite and deep and meaningful, and I owed it to the creation to keep going. And then I thought about all the refugees and the Syrians that walked, I thought about all the Syrians and Iraqis and all the people that just walked on foot and they kept walking to freedom. And so I really needed a freedom from the idea that I could only create something if it was acceptable by the establishment.
Right. Yeah, it's really sad, but it's going back to what you're talking about not giving up. It's amazing how you can get a negative reference from somebody you reached out to, a book publisher or whatever, and they reject you, and then you get a review where they praise you. That just happened to me today, where someone told me that they read my book and they loved it. Man, that is like gas. It's like a full tank of gas. And I just sit down and just keep going, because that really propels me forward. And I think that's probably the case with most writers when they're starting out, like us. I don't know if that gets less as you go along. Like I keep referring to someone like Stephen King, where it doesn't matter anymore because you've already made your niche and you know where you're going and where you've been, and whatever you write is going to be swallowed up. But it's dramatic in how you feel that keeps you going like that. I know, Terry, you're on a rush, I think, now, and I think you can relate to that.
Yeah, I am totally on a rush, but I can really understand when she said she felt like she was being spit out. I know that when mine was finally accepted, I was so overwhelmed. I was crying while kind of laughing, and I couldn't hear anything. Like, they were talking to me, and I don't know what was said for about 10 minutes because I was so emotionally, and I just kept thinking, oh, my gosh, someone thinks I'm good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Someone thinks I'm good enough. They don't think I'm a terrible writer. Like, I had gotten to the point where I just believed maybe I'm an awful writer. And then when you have someone who believes in you, it's just amazing. So I agree.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very – and I know that you have a different feeling because of being an immigrant. I don't have that. But even so, it's enough to just – it makes you want to crawl up under the bed and not come out.
And then I realized, and I really want to say this to your listeners, is that the best antidepressant on the planet is creativity. And how many times there's not a single antidepressant that's going to bring you to consciousness, and art and creativity will. I mean, to turn trauma,
exactly,
and to turn such historical trauma into art, that's what picked me up. That's what kept me going, when I could feel the vitality coming through as I create a scene, and then I dedicate that scene in my heart to all these people that had gone through lives so much more difficult than mine. So that's what I want to say, is like, pick up a pen, paint a picture, scribble something, because that's the best antidepressant on the planet.
Yep, I agree. I want to remind everybody, we're talking to Dorita Bosey. Did I get that right, Rita?
You did. Thank you.
All right. I'm winning here. So if you'd like to give us a call, if you're out there listening live, which I know you are, call us at 914-219-0868, and we'd love to talk to you. And I know, Rita, that you and Terry have been published with Atmosphere Press. It's a plug here for them. I know they've done a lot, and they've been connected with our show, too, and we appreciate that. What has that process and experience been like for you? You did touch on it, but could you get more into detail and how that went?
Well, I was just really impressed with their organizational skills. I mean, and all the different pieces, how they have it so beautifully set up. Everything was beautifully laid out, and every step of the way, they were ushering you into sort of the next apartment. So it felt like they'd given it a lot of deep consideration and thought on how to make the experience as seamless as possible. So I really appreciated that. And it was really fantastic to be able to collaborate on the cover. I know that I'm a very visual person, so it just was really wonderful to be able to have a say in a cover that's so big. And, you know, there's so much you learn being so hands-on in the process with it. There's so much I learned about what goes into creating a book. So it's kind of like watching how to build a house. It's like kind of how do you get a book out there? So I've learned a lot in the process, and they've been, you know, very enthusiastic and timely. And yeah, it was a really excellent experience working with them.
Very good. Terry?
So I'm curious, where do you go to write, and do you have a favorite place that you write?
I have a really good question for a really good answer for this. I was thinking about this. So I remember as I was in my process hearing that from other writers that they can only write at their desk at a certain time of day. And then I read an article up in the Globe and Mail from Toronto about a writer who she had just received some sort of a big award. It took her 7 years to write her book. And she was raising two very young children at the time, and she barely had any time. And she said during that time, she would write for like 5 minutes or 10 minutes or three lines or one line, and eventually the book got written in 7 years. And so that really inspired me, because I'm not just a writer. I have a private practice. I'm a somatic relational trauma-informed therapist. So, you know, I have this whole other life, and there were times where I couldn't write. So I decided early on that I was going to write at any time in any place. So I would write on Christmas Day. I would write on New Year's Eve. I would write wherever, whatever country I was in, whatever cafe, whatever library. So I love the libraries. This book was written in cafes in Istanbul, in Budapest, in Prague, in Estonia, like, so essentially cafes, libraries, and at one time it was in the basement of my home. So wherever I find myself, oh, I'll be in the middle of a show, like a theater show or a dance show, and I'll be scribbling something in a line into my little black book that I pull out of my purse. So I'll write anywhere at any time.
Yeah, I love that you pick up a pen and actually do it the old-fashioned way. I was just reading something about, as I just mentioned, Stephen King. After he was hit with an automobile in 1999, he was knocked to the side of the road and very severely injured. Well, after that, it took a lot for him to get back into his work, and the way he did it was, since he couldn't sit up very well or get in position as he would in front of a typewriter or a computer, he picked up a pen and paper and started writing that way. And he said it brought him back, I think the words he used, it brought him back to the language stronger than it's ever done anywhere or any way else. So I'm wondering, mm-hmm. when you're saying that you write with pen and paper, does it flow easier that way, or what happens when that happens?
Well, you know, to be honest, it's ideas that I write down with pen and paper, or an image. That maybe dialogue, I'll write, but actually I really do need the computer to capture things just because my hand just can't write that fast anymore. But I love, I'll put in a scene idea, or I'll put in a line that I heard somewhere, and all of a sudden when I sit down to write, it just springs forward. So I do more like images, thoughts, ideas, or a detail. And that just gets me writing for hours, just one line, you know?
So getting away from writing a novel like you've just done, you co-wrote a play. Can you tell us about that and how it is different than writing a novel?
Yeah, well, actually, I co-wrote a number of plays. The one that was very much a collaboration was something called 52 Pickups. But in a novel, the dialogue is more sparse, and in a novel, you control what the reader looks at. In a play, you're looking at the whole stage, okay? And so, And the other thing about a novel is that a novel you get the interior life of the character, but in a play, the whole thing, everything is revealed through dialogue. So we kind of sense the interior life of a character by how they're speaking to each other. What I find really interesting about Margaret Atwood talks about this is that a well-written novel creates such quick neural connections in the brain that a reader experiences the place as if it were actually there. Their imagination creates a setting and experience. And then when you're in a play, the director is kind of controlling what you're looking at because of the lighting, because of the scene. But in a novel, which I really love about novels, is that you're making up these characters in your mind. You know, it turns on these neural pathways. You know, it's kind of like stories inscribe us, you know? So it's quite a different, I mean, does it take longer to write a novel? I think so. You can write a play in a shorter amount of time, but they're not easier really necessarily to write either, like brilliant plays. Yeah, so that's kind of the difference about, I guess, how I see it. But again, I didn't know what I was doing when I was writing the play. Same thing. You know,
right.
I'm one of these people that go, oh, this looks really interesting. I want to try it. See what it's like to do it.
Yeah. Well, what are the titles of your plays?
Oh, the titles of my plays. So one is 52 Pickup, co-written by TJ Daw. It was his idea. And then another play was called Bloodline, and that was a physical theater play. Another play that was co-written by three of us, with Jan Derbyshire as well, was Ingenious Speculations. And then we did a collaboration in Calgary called Doppelganger. So that was directed by my husband, and we all pitched in to write that one as well. And I really do like collaborative writing. It's quite fun. It's challenging and also very, very fun.
Uh-huh. Terry, your next question?
Yeah. So as a writer and author, what's something that you'd like your readers to know about you and why you write?
Well, I would like I would love for people to know about me that I've worked really, really hard to become a human. I was born into trauma. My parents were very traumatized by their situation in Hungary, by separation, and so I've worked very, very hard to understand myself, to understand people, to grow empathy for myself and for other people, and understand that we behave the way we do because of our oppressive societies, because of survival. We're not doubles. We just have sometimes made the best choices we can in horrendous situations. I personally write from my body. That's really important. I care about people and what people go through to survive. And I write to understand about what happened, as so many writers do, but I kind of write to understand what happened, because that's how I develop empathy for my family, for myself, for cultures. Yeah, that's what I'd like people to know about me and why
and
I write to understand.
And you're also a therapist. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, it was sort of a natural evolution. I had started my life as a classical dancer. I became a modern dancer, then an actor, and then I started my hand at writing. And then I got an agent. I got into theater and television, and then, you know, somehow I kind of burned myself out on performing. And I remember having a phenomenal therapist from Brooklyn when I was 21, and I was in such awe of what he knew and how he did what he did, that I think I sensed someday, at one point, that someday I'm going to be doing this myself, helping other people make sense of their lives and the complexity of their experiences. So, yeah, I kind of went at it in an alternative route. My work is trauma-informed, and that's really particular. That's really important. That's a very empathy-based way of working. It's client-centered. It's body-centered. It's standing that we are not – it's not pathologizing or shaming people, but really getting to know that underneath all our adaptations and survival adaptations, there's a terror and horror and fear, and that there's also, there's a human being underneath there, and everyone deserves the respect of being treated like a human, no matter how horrible the actions they've perpetrated. I really want to plug this, is that there's a Netflix series called The World's Toughest Prisons, and there's a prison in Cyprus that used to be the worst prison on the planet, and where, you know, inmates were regularly beaten by guards, and it was taken over by a human rights lawyer, and she completely transformed this prison, and the guards were no longer allowed to beat the inmates ever. They were had to treat them as human beings, and this is actually a place where people are learning to heal, because so many criminals come from horrendous backgrounds, horrendous, horrific childhood trauma. And it was so inspiring to see someone get it, really get it, that no one deserves to be hunted. No one deserves to be beaten down. No one deserves that. And everyone comes from some place where, you know, the humanity, the empathy, the care, their situation, they were not cared for the way they needed to be cared for. And, of course, you know, in some of these, I was just saying to myself, in these other prisons in Bosnia, you look at some of these inmates, they were children that saw their parents gunned down. Their dad is gone, and the only thing they have left to do to become a part of a gang so that they can actually feed themselves, right? So, you know, as a therapist and in my writing, I think I really have a big message of take a real good look at where people come from and the societies they've come from and the oppressive situations they've come from. And then, you know, then take a look. Like, we have to help people heal. No matter what these people have done, we have to help them heal, you know.
Mm-hmm. Terry?
Yeah, no, I'm sitting here just kind of in awe. That's wonderful. So I'm curious, let's switch gears just a little bit. When it comes to reviews, how important are they to you?
Well, that's a really great question, and I wish I could say they weren't that important, but, you know, having a career in dance and theater, I couldn't help myself. I'd always, you know, at the time it was newspapers, we'd run to the newspaper, rip it open to see what, you know, the critics said. And
right.
I'd be lying if I said they didn't matter, because certainly it, I think with this novel, and I'm going to be so frank about this, with this novel, I worked so damn hard. I worked 9 years plus another 2, you know, after I got rejections, I kept writing, rewriting. And I know the work I put into this. And so when, and fortunately, about 5 of my editorial reviews have been smashing. They've been, you know, 5-star reviews. People that get it really, really get this novel, and they see the depth of the work and the research and character development. And there were a couple of reviews. There was one person that gave me a 3-star review, and I thought, I wonder, like, she must have been so bored the day she picked up this novel. I mean, I couldn't take it personally at all, because I just thought, did you actually read the book, or what did you actually do, or did you get someone else to read it? Because I'm not here to say that this is a fantastic novel, but there's work in it, you know. It's like, it
right.
does paint a picture. So I feel confident in the work, and that's because I worked hard. And so the reviews that I have gotten that have been really favorable, it's really wonderful. It's really exciting to me to go, it's not so much about what they're saying about me. I'm so excited that someone got a scene or got a line, or that it impressed them in some way because it brought it to life for them. So that's what I got excited about.
Yeah.
Less about what they were saying about the novel, but that they had an experience with it. And that really meant a lot to me.
Yeah. So, Rita, we're getting close here to the ending of our program. Wish we could go on, but we have about 7 minutes left. Or actually, I'm looking, it's a little more than 5. This would be your Oscar moment, as we say here on the Writer's Lounge. Any parting words of advice to aspiring authors? And would you like to thank anyone out there for the successes that you've obviously enjoyed in life so far?
Well, I would like to thank my parents for bringing me into the world, and for sharing my mother, who so generously shared of her stories. My mother, oh my God, she told me such difficult stories, and she told them to me in such great detail and things that were hard to speak of. So I have just a depth of gratitude for my mother, for reliving, and so many of my relatives that I interviewed that relived such difficult times. Profound gratitude for my husband, who tirelessly stood by me every time I collapsed, and then every time I faced difficult notes, he would be there to interpret them. He's a playwright himself. Adrienne Kerr, she's an incredible freelance editor in Toronto. So I worked with her for many years. I was very appreciative of Kyle McCord for picking up after working with, you know, Adrienne for 2 years. And what I would say is words of advice. This is really important. Don't rush writing your book. In this time of instant books and Instagram and instant everything and instant communication, I think that we run the risk of not deepening our work. And people are trying to spit out novels so quickly. You know, there was a time where people took 10 years to write a novel, and I couldn't understand it at the time, but now I do. So I say, take the time, don't try to write it too quickly, and then you get depth of work. Then you get some perspective. Yeah, take your time. Don't rush. There is no rush. You know, what is the rush?
Interesting advice. Yeah. Very interesting advice. And well taken for that. How can listeners contact you if they'd like to purchase your book or see what you're going to be doing next?
Yeah, that's super easy. My website, ritabozi.com, RitaBozi.com, is my website. And you can reach me through my website.
Very good. Terry, any parting words for Rita?
I'm so glad that she came on the show. I have a feeling that you and I would be able to talk quite a bit about the writing process. And I just want to assure you that even though it felt chaotic when you were doing it, that it probably wasn't as chaotic as it felt. It was just that you hadn't done it before, so it just felt crazy. But, you know, I'm now working on my third novel, and I'm doing it relatively the same way, but I'm doing it without feeling like it's as crazy because I know that it's going to work out in the end. So, yeah, I hope you keep writing. I do.
Right.
I've got 200 pages of my next book already written.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Very good, Rita. Keep it going.
Thank you so much. It was lovely
to
speak to you both.
It's been a great time. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Bye.
And there goes Rita Bozi. And for some reason, oh, there it goes. Just kind of fiddling around with the switchboard here, Terry. Final chapter, final thoughts and intro to the next show. I was very impressed with Rita. And one thing that I'm always impressed with, and even more so, is the intellect of the authors that we bring on to the Writer's Lounge. They're very intelligent, not just in writing, but in their other parts of their lives too. And I'm glad, and I was just given some heads up and some thumbs up about highlighting some of the other things that our authors do, not just writing. So do you agree with that, Terry?
Oh, absolutely. I think that what authors have done before and what they're currently doing add a lot of depth to their story, and it kind of helps you see a little bit, you know, when you know, for instance, that you know, Rita is a therapist, you and then read her story, you'll see some of that in there and you'll recognize that. I think it's really interesting how the things we've done in our life creep up into the work that we do.
Right, right. So next time around, on 2 weeks from tonight, Terry will be taking off her co-host hat and putting on her author hat, and we will have her talking about An Enemy Like Me, and Terry Brown will discuss her just-released new novel, and that would be it. And I hope you will enjoy that show. I know it'll be fun talking to Terry about her next endeavor. And until then, Terry and I will see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we encourage writers and readers to keep the pen and the eyes to the page and to let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well, and have a good night. Bye-bye.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. Of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make